The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual participants and do not necessarily reflect the official position of the host, other guests, or any affiliated entities. Each participant is responsible for their own statements and opinions. Viewer and listener discretion is advised.
Hola, bien chada! Thank you for tuning in to this inaugural episode of High Trust Grow Context, episode uno, setting the stage. I'm your host, El Chaco, and with me tonight, we've got an awesome guest lined up, ready to talk trust and truth. It's none other than my good friend and former co-host of Here's What I Don't Get, Mr. Tab Burt. Tab is a highly sought after technical expert in the theater world, having demonstrated his skills as a lighting and stage designer on stages all across the United States. He's also found solace in his new hobby of glassblowing and is an absolute encyclopedia of knowledge on movies and all things Star Trek. So without further ado, let's go, Tab. Hey, man, thanks for being the first guest on High Contact or High Trust Low Contact. I'm gonna get that one out of
Thanks for having me, El Chaco. Boy, it's been a while since anybody's introduced me so nicely on a show.
Well, you know, I wanted to dig into your technical background because I know that you brought it up a bunch of times when we were on Here's What I Don't Get. But I think that there's a skill set in there that not a lot of people think about. Because, like, you know, I've been in show business, you've been in show business, and there's a lot of prep work that goes into making a show work. And, you know, especially like we were just mentioning off air, you were just telling me about your private concert with Green Day at one point in time. You want to share that?
So a couple of years ago, right after the lockdowns all ended and things were opening back up, Green Day came to Tulsa and I was managing the labor at the arena there in town. And so for 2 weeks they didn't shut down. The arena wasn't open to the public, but Green Day was loaded in and they were checking their sound setups and checking their lighting setups and going through rehearsals. And so we did a couple of evenings of rehearsal with Green Day where I was basically the only spectator in the arena that wasn't kind of directly affiliated with the show. So I like to joke and say that I saw Green Day in concert by myself, and not by myself as in I went all alone, but as in I was the only person there. It was a really, really surreal experience to have like all of this production and then absolutely none of the energy that happens when you have like a huge crowd that's there. And it was one of those experiences that I can never articulate for people. Cause then like the next week, so we did 2 weeks of Green Day and then we did another week where Phish did the same thing. And they rehearsed silly stuff. Like Green Day, we loaded out one night. We, you know, it was 10 p.m., the time the show would normally end. Crew arrived and loaded the show out, put all their stuff in trucks. The trucks pulled away from the building. And then they kind of just circled the block all night, I guess. And they pulled back in the next morning at 8 a.m. And we loaded that same show right back in. And you know, we're used to it. We've done that kind of thing where we load in a show at the load out a show at the arena one night and the next morning we're back and we load the show back in. It's usually not the same show. And the show's used to that too, where they load out and the next day they do a show somewhere else, but they're usually not back in the same arena. So, but it was one of those things that had to be rehearsed. They had to know how a loadout went before so that when they were there out in, you know, Toronto or somewhere trying to load a show out, they weren't suddenly realizing that, this stuff doesn't really fit on the trucks the way we thought it was going to.
Well, those are the things that people don't always think about, right? Like, I mean, you just mentioned really quickly there about them circling the block, right? Like, I mean, when you've got like these long ass trucks going on, you can't exactly just like park, right? Like a lot of those theaters don't exactly have the proper parking in front of them. Like when I was doing the Midget Wrestling Warriors, I was the, not only doing Don Chaco in the shows, but I was also the driver for the tour. So basically I was driving an RV and we had a tour bus, like a, not a tour bus. That was our tour bus, the RV. We had the, like a trailer behind us and we would be, you know, like a couple of places we did one that was like a bar,
right? Like it was, mm-hmm. it was like a bar show. And the thing is, like, we had to go in the alley. And it, like, actually the other thing, I had to take the trailer with me to pick up all the talent from the airport, but there was no way that we could just like stop. And there was no parking spot in the airport for something that long. So we, yeah, we burned a lot of gas, just like just going around and around and around and around. And it's not really comfortable to drive with the trailer, but like, that's the thing is that like, especially like, for example, like stadium shows and stuff like that, you know, like I was just looking at the schedule in Calgary and like, so the Calgary Flames schedule is already been released. And like, there's concert times that have to be kind of afforded for in that period of time. Like, so when they book those concerts, they're booking those concerts months and months and months in advance. Years. Yeah. That's the thing. Yeah. And the thing is like, you have to put into time to like, okay, there's a hockey rink under here. So there's like ice in there. You can't just like chop up and get the ice out. You have to like make sure like, oh, game's over, clean the ice. We're going to put the boards down and you got to move everything out of the way. Like there's a lot of sleepless nights for the people that are involved with those kind of things. But like in your situation right now, you work in a proper theater. And so whenever a new show comes in, like walk me through the process of, let's say when they book a show, let's say they're going to do like Pirates of Penzance or something like that. Right. Mm-hmm. Like if you get that ahead of time, like who starts with it and how does it kind of walk yourself? Like walk me through the process of like, we're going to do Pirates of Penzance and go.
So a lot of those, a lot of shows, they start a year before the, so let's say you're going to have a show in September, right? That's, this is your big Pirates of Penzance. That's your big opening for your season. Well, you started talking about that in December or January of the year before, when the artistic team, the artistic director for whatever theater group you had, they sat down and they said, all right, what's our season next year? What kind of, we, you know, this is our demographic. We need a show that'll appeal to this demographic. We need to have our kids show. We need to do a musical. We need to do a straight play, like whatever your criteria for picking a show is, right? So that's all happening in January and February of the year. So you get mm-hmm. all that stuff figured out. You come around to April, you're ending your season. You know, let's call it season one. Season two opens with Pirates of Penzance. End of season one, that final show is opening up in April, and opening night you have your big gala, or you have a big season reveal gala where you say, next year, coming to our theater, we're going to have Pirates of Penzance. We're going to be doing Matilda the Children's Musical. We're going to be doing, you know, Verdi's whatever, you know, and you're listing all the stuff you're going to be doing. And everyone's super excited about that. And also about that same time, you're starting to call designers. You have to call usually your scenic designer and your costume designer. Those are the first two. You've got to get them in because you need a scenic design so that you have a you know, a set to act on. And I guess before that, you have your, you have to get your directors in. And so some theater companies, they have like a core of directors that actually work for them, and sometimes you contract out. But in every case, whenever you're deciding that season, you're picking that director. And then the director may say, oh, no, I don't like working with that scenic designer. I want to work with this scenic designer that I like. So you're getting those people under contracts. And so you're talking about in April, March and April, you're already spending a third of your season budget, or a third of for next year, on contracting your designers, because most designers get paid on a 30-30-30 scale, or mm-hmm. a 30-40-30 scale, where you get 30% of your fee up front, right when you sign the contract, that check comes. You get 30% of your fee when you turn in your first set of draftings, and then you get the last 30% of your fee on opening night. Just typically how those are laid
opening
out.
Night.
On opening night.
So like your budget is basically 2/3 up until, yes. right? Or are you guys mm-hmm. running in debt? Oh, wow.
Most people are running off of the check that they had from the show they just walked away from. So opening night hits and I get paid for this show, and I walk to the next theater and start my next show that I've been paid 2/3 of already. And I'm hoping that mm-hmm. in a week's time, I'll get another, the next third. And so you're like constantly chasing that money train and always trying to stay one step ahead of the bills. But so March and April, as the producer, you've spent a third of your season budget to get those people on board. They're reading the play or the musical. They're doing research. They're putting together draftings, and you start having meetings. And you're probably starting to have your meetings in late May and June talking about this September show. And by the 1st of July, you finalized all of your designs. This is what the costumes are going to look like. This is what the set's going to look like. This is who the stage manager is going to be. These are my like lighting ideas. So about 8 weeks out from your opening, you start rehearsals with your actors. And also about that same time, the scene shop starts building your set. So they have about 6 weeks to build it and then 2 weeks to load in. And somewhere in that load in time, your lighting designer show, your a lighting crew shows up and hangs your show. So we're talking about somewhere in August, in July and August, the set's getting built. The actors are rehearsing. Somewhere in late August, the electricians show up to the theater and hang a light plot. The sound engineer comes in and starts to put speakers where they go if they're not using a house system. The lighting designer comes in and focuses all the lights. The painters are coming in and painting. Then about 2 weeks out from opening, all those elements start to come together in tech week. So you're doing rehearsals with the actors in the set. And then once you kind of got, and the lighting, and once you kind of got that all squared away, then you add costumes and you like add bits as you go until finally that like last three nights, you're basically doing the show and probably either to no audience or a very, very small audience of these are my donors. These are my, these are the close friends of the designers that are poor and don't want to pay to see the show. And then finally, right. Like that Friday, September 1st, you have your big opening night gala. Everyone comes in. Everyone's happy to be there. Well, I guess it wouldn't be September 1st. It would be somewhere in mid-September, but you have this big event but at the same time all of that has been happening, you're now probably 2 weeks into the next rehearsal process of the next show, because rarely do you see theater companies like, well, they'll do one show and then take 3 months off before the next show. They've got a show in like 3 or 4 weeks that's going to open up right on the heels of that. So you're like in this constant production. And on my side, as a designer side, even as an audio engineer, I'm like mixing this show. I'm working on this show. And in pre-show, I'm working on the next, sound plot that I have. I'm writing cues for the next show. I'm lighting. I'm reading scripts for the show that I'm going to be doing in the spring. And you're constantly like chasing, because if you pause for too long, the checks will stop coming and then you die.
And you're going to go out of business. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like, just so I have this clear. So you personally will be kind of time managing a whole bunch of stuff at the same time. You'll be, like working on your beats for the lighting on one show, while at the same time kind of working with the lighting designer for the, like, you're not like, do you work hand in hand with the lighting designer? Are sometimes you the lighting designer? I know that you've talked about sometimes where you've had to kind of fill in for some of the scene design stuff, or not the design, but at least like the construction of it. Is that correct?
So in my current position, I'm the technical director. And so I oversee all the technical aspects of everything that comes through my theater doors. So I'm looking at scenic draftings to make sure that it's going to be something that will fit, something that can hold weight of people, something that, I think can get there. I'm looking at light plots to make sure they like fit within our inventory. I'm looking at scheduling crew to hang that light plot. I'm going through and helping put all that information into a sheet so that the programmer and the lighting designer can then program their console. I'm there to answer questions when they don't know how to use the lighting console. So my current job requires me to know a little bit of everything so that I can just constantly be answering questions. And even so, right now we're in this renovation, we're totally dark. This summer has been really, really odd for me, because I have been basically without a show for the last, since June. June was the last show that I did. And basically, other than the lockdowns, I have never not been in production. So I've had I've had evenings and weekends and all these things that I've never had in my career before. And now I'm really starting to grow attached to this idea of, oh, this is the way normal people live. I like being normal people. But even now, I had a tour with a theater company that rents our space. They just hired a new technical director that has never seen our space before. Their show is in January. They load in January 2nd, or third, whatever, the first day of January that's not a holiday, they load in their show. And they came to the theater yesterday, to walk Tuesday, the end of August, to walk through the space and see all the bits and try and figure out how their show's going to work. So, you know, they're looking 3 months down the line before they even walk in the door on this show to try and solve these problems early on. And so I'm talking about that show. I'm starting to schedule crew for my shows that are in November. I'm starting to look at light plots for the show that's in October.
And then once leaving it to the last minute. You're never leaving it to the last minute.
I'm never leaving it to the last minute.
But do shows ever leave it to the last minute? Do you end up spending a lot of like stuff kind of fixing at the last moment and all that kind of stuff?
In this current job, that seems to be the exclusive thing that I do. As a designer, I've always prided myself on, like, I always beat my deadline. Like you have 8 weeks of rehearsal time. You have 6 weeks of build time for your show. Well, the scenic draftings have to be in 2 weeks before that build time starts, so that the technical director I'm a venue technical director versus like a carpenter technical director. A carpenter technical director, the scenic designer draws kind of a pretty picture. This is what I want this to look like. And a carpentry technical director takes those drawings and figures out how they actually get built. So the scenic designer has to turn those drawings into the technical director so that they can draw the actual build drawings so they can give those to the shop so that they can get built. So I always mentally set my own deadline a week ahead of whatever the deadline is, so that if something terrible happens, I have a built-in buffer zone, or if you send something and it's corrupted, I can replace it right away. We didn't tell you all those moving lights you hung in this plot. We had a flood of our basement. They all got ruined. That happened to me in college where the AC got plumbed incorrectly and our basement flooded and it destroyed all these moving lights we were supposed to have. They ended up getting replaced through insurance, but there was a 12-week period where we didn't have any lights and they were supposed to be in these shows. And then it was like, well, now I have to redraft my whole thing. And there was this panic. And that was what caused me to start thinking it. So when they say something like that, I can be like, well, I've got 5x more days. Let me fucking go as fast as I can to put this together and send it to you so that I can move on to my next project so that I can keep getting paid. Cause it's a train. You're always on this train.
That's the sign of a good pro though, is somebody who can kind of like take the lead when things go awry. You know, like for example, I know when we first did Luchando, our first night, like it was really down to the last minute. It was horrifying. When we were doing it, because basically so you said you got paid, you know, you guys get paid like a third and then a third and then a third. Whereas with mine, ours was a lot of fake it till you make it. Right. So basically I had put out a business plan to, a bunch of investors and we got commitments from them, but they were only if we got all of the money. So like, basically like we needed to raise $500,000. And if we didn't get a commitment for $500,000, then we got $0. But thankfully, our first investor had actually committed $50,000. And with that is what I was able to bring in, $100,000. And that's what I was able to bring in the wrestlers with, bring in the ring in with, build the set with. So like when we came in, we had an empty warehouse. So like when I was trying to figure out what our setting was going to be, it's not like we were going to do it in a proper theater. It's not like we were going to be able, like, actually one of the thoughts we had was we were going to do it basketball is not a huge sport here, but it's the number two sport in Paraguay. So a lot of the football clubs also have matching basketball clubs. And so Olympia has the biggest basketball stadium. It's actually where the original wrestling show in Paraguay took place, was at Olympia's basketball stadium. So I remember when we looked into it, we were like, maybe we do it here, right? It's already got the stands. It's already got the like speakers. It's got everything ready. But I got like strong feedback from my creative director saying, we will look like complete clowns if we open to like a half empty basketball stadium.
Arena.
Yeah. So we were like, oh, yeah, fair point. You know, I was like, oh, we can fake it. We can do a smoke and mirrors. We can drape a black, you know, black curtain behind, and we could do all kinds of stuff to kind of, you know, like huddle everybody into the corner and only put the camera in that one direction and all that kind of stuff. But it didn't really, that was not going to be. So luckily, like the TV studio that we ended up getting our show originally on, that we had a primetime slot with, they had this like storage warehouse at the back where they kept a lot of their costumes and sets for all of their other shows. And basically we partitioned it with curtains so that our dressing rooms were basically, you know, amongst all of the like set design for all the other stuff. And then we had to get built stands. So it was like this like brick wall. And then like behind it was like a little, like the bathrooms were underneath. And then there was a hallway down through this like little kitchen area. And we had to build the stands down. And I remember like, it was like, bit by bit, as we were getting closer and closer to the opening night, it was terrifying. It was terrifying because in Paraguay, it's a mañana culture. So everybody always tells you, yeah, we're going to get that done mañana, mañana, mañana. And I'll never forget, because like on opening night, it wasn't finished. It just wasn't finished. And so like we got the lighting rig put up literally the night before. And we had the stands put in. They were done. And I remember when they finished the stands and our guys were kind of running through a practice run, and I was in the stands and I got the first chance of actually just kind of like taking it all in. There's my ring. There it is with the lights on it. This is what everybody's going to see when they come for the very first show. And the very first show was actually on my wife. It was, I don't know if it was exactly on my wife's birthday or was the day after my wife's birthday, but like we had a little VIP section. And I wasn't actually on the show yet. My character wasn't actually brought onto the show until I think episode 3 or 4. So the first tapings, I wasn't on the show. My character hadn't been introduced yet. So I actually got to like watch the show from the VIP booth. And it was terrifying because the thing is that like we had two sets of people. We had, you know, like our creative director didn't speak any Spanish. And then we had a translator in between, and we had a guy on a radio headset kind of going back and forth. We had to make sure that they got the music cues and the lighting cues for every single wrestler. You have to know that like when a wrestler comes out, you're going to play his entrance music and he's going to come out, and you got to know when to turn it off, right? You don't just turn it off when you think it's time to turn it off. You got to know the timing for when to turn it off. You then also need to know at the end, whoever's going to win the match. Right. So if you tell them ahead of time, predetermined, this is the person that's going to win the match, you got to play his victory music.
Whoa, then you
also have to instruct them and tell them, hey, listen, sometimes things go wrong. Sometimes things go wrong. And the guy we originally intended to win the match isn't going to be like, something goes wrong in the middle of the match, and you have to kind of call an audible. And then you have to know that you're going to trust your lighting and your sound people, that they'll know that that wrestler's win music or that wrestler's, to not play the wrong wrestler's music when the guy gets the 1, 2, 3. And so it was super terrifying, but at the same time, like as we got going throughout the season, it just got smoother and smoother and smoother to the point where everything was perfectly timed. Everything worked out perfectly. I actually prepared a little bit of a little slideshow that I wanted to show you real quick of some of the things from opening night for us. So the first night, we weren't sure if we were going to have a crowd. The thing about Paraguay is that it gets like, when the rain comes, you're not going to get like the crowd. There are a lot of people are coming by bus. And if the rain comes in, this isn't a country that has like proper storm drains and stuff for everything. Mm-hmm. So if there's a big, huge rainstorm, you got no show until you have like a completely, totally loyal fan base. So we took this picture on the first night because it was really cool that you can't really quite see, but it's wrapped all the way around the building. Where these fans were coming in for the first show. And then we had like this kind of the feeling of anticipation for when the crowd is coming, because a little bit different from like a stage show, all the lights, everything is pointed, all the direction of the attention is on the stage, right? Mm-hmm. But like in a wrestling show, because our this is a hard cam angle right here, the crowd is a part of the stage, right? So it's like we had to make sure that we had the lighting just right so that when the match was going on, you could see them and like that they show up just as much as the match does. And like I said before, we ended up having this little hallway. And then we would just basically come down the hallway and then turn left. And then that's when the camera would catch you. And we'd have lights set up in the hallway or at the turn. You can see the little light switches like over his hand here. That's where the bathroom is. And so basically like we didn't open the bathroom up to the public, but like there was porta potties outside. But like we had him come and turn and come down the entrances that way. So this is Sully right here. And, you know, it was like, if it's Sully coming down, you got to know it's red lights. If it's Spinelli coming down, it's going to be purple lights. If it's going to be, you know, Ray Dragon, it's going to be green lights. And so they have to know all that kind of stuff because lighting matters, right? Lighting sets a mood, right? Mm-hmm. And so like, you know, if you don't do the right lighting, then it like, I don't think a lot of people really truly understand the value of a properly set stage, a properly set lighting, properly set sound, all those kind of things. Like, we had to put a microphone underneath the ring, right? Because the thing is that like, you know, when somebody gets body slammed, I want to hear it. I want to, you know, I want to hear that on camera. That's a big deal. And like when somebody's punching somebody, I mean, you know, yeah, the punch looks like it connects, but the big thing that makes it feel like it connects is because the wrestler is stomping his foot at the same time as he's delivering that punch. And so, you know, like when you're going in and you're dealing with the crowd, the lighting, setting the thing properly does everything. Because if the crowd walks in and it's this kind of jabroni basketball arena that's like half full and nobody's, you know, it's not set up right. Like, it's not your home, right? Like, mm-hmm. we have to set it up every time and we have to take it down every time. And but like when the show got really going, it really made a difference over time. And then actually by the end, they loved us. I mean, they absolutely loved us. Lighting, it's funny because in movies, I don't think a lot of people truly believe how or truly recognize how much lighting makes a difference and the music for setting the tone or an emotion for a scene. So when you're doing like lighting and sound design, a lot of the emotion that the audience is feeling is at your fingertips, right? Like it's at your fingertips, and that's a lot of power. That's, you know,
I also, one of the cool things about lighting is, so, you know, I took a lot of light design classes, of course, in college. And one of the first rules that you learn is darkness is not a choice. Like, that's the default, and that's almost kind of biblical, right? You know, at first there was nothing, and then God said, let there be light.
That was setting the stage. God setting the stage right there.
Yeah. Well, you know what the difference is between God and lighting designers? God doesn't think he's a lighting designer.
He literally designed light. He is light. Anyway.
Anyway, one of the things that you learn very quickly is most directors, they don't want to see the scene change, right? We need to be over here. Like, we're over here in this happy little picnic scene, and then we're going to transition, and we need to be like in this intense courtroom scene, and they need to feel totally different. Like, you can't just be in the same spot. But also, we need, like, it takes us 45 seconds to set up the courtroom scene, and it takes us 22 seconds to get rid of the park scene. And so we're going to set the park scene over here on the left, and we're going to set the courtroom scene over here on the right. And you turn on the lights over here on the left for this whole park thing. And then kind of, you know, bring it down as the park scene ends, but not too much. Not so it feels like it's getting sad, just enough that we can get the courtroom kind of up and running, so that we just kind of turn the park scene off. And then we only wait a handful of seconds before the lights come up in the courtroom, so that people aren't just sitting there in the dark going, I wonder what's going to happen next. And Well, so you also kind of trick people into looking at the right thing, or then it trick their mind into the magic happening of, oh, what that's happening over there? I had no idea. I was so focused on what was going on over here. Cause you have a literal spotlight that you're shining where you want them to go.
Well, I never knew that about the darkness is not a choice. I really like that. Cause like when I got trained in radio, the silence is death, right? Like you can't have dead air, right? So if you have too long a period of time with dead air, it's like people are going to tune off your station. They're not going to listen anymore. They're going to think your antenna went down or something like that. So it's funny because like we always need something. We always need to move on to the next thing. It's like basically like life is scrolling at all times. You always need something coming up, right? And I can see that in the theater as well. I remember when I was a kid, one of my favorite things, I think I saw it about maybe two or three times. Have you ever heard of Famous People Players?
I have not.
So Famous People Players was like a puppet show, but it was done with like black lights. Like it was like, people wearing all black leotard suit, kind of like Green Man from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, but like all black. And then they're against a black backdrop, but then like they're using puppets that are all like, you know, like
neon,
fluorescent neon, and they pop. And so when you're watching it as a kid, it's like these musical notes that are like coming out of this puppet Liberace's piano that are kind of coming away from it. And it looked so cool. And it was a thing that like, they always say like, you want to get the audience to immerse itself. You want them to feel like a part of it. And you want them to really feel a part, like that there's to dismantle their disbelief, right? Mm-hmm. So like if in wrestling, if we do something, if our punches look like crap, right? If a slap looks like crap, then you're going to take the audience completely out of it. They're not going to be able to go along with it. They're just kind of going to give up on the whole thing. And I mean, that's what happens a lot of times. Like people grow up and they go, wrestling's fake, I'm out. And like, they don't want to be a part of it anymore because they feel silly. You don't want the audience to feel silly that they're in, you know, trying to enjoy something like that. It's a little different with movies.
I disagree. I don't think it's different with movies. I think that, sometimes when a movie is really good, you forget you're watching it, right? You get so engaged with the story. You're so involved. You kind of forget that they're not real people. You forget even movies that I've seen 100 times, like the really good ones, the things that really build nice, like The Thing. I watched The Thing recently and it has such great tension, and I've seen it a dozen times, but that scene where Kurt Russell is like testing everyone's blood and he's like, I know I'm a human.
Right.
It's so intense. And even though I know who the Thing monsters are, I know who makes it to the end. I know Childs is the last Thing monster and Kurt Russell is the last man standing. I know that. Right. I've seen the movie. I still get so invested in that. I remember this guy, Vic Mignogna, he made a tribute season of Star Trek, the original series, to kind of bridge season 3 of Star Trek, the original series, to the beginning of Star Trek, the motion picture.
Okay. And this is like a fan fiction type stuff.
It was a fan film series, there's been a lot of fan film series, and a lot of them, they don't take the time to make it look like Star Trek. They'll build a nice set. They'll buy the costumes, but they don't like get the lighting right. He had the lighting right. He had the music right. He had the way the camera moved right. It moved like a camera in the 60s, which is different than the way a camera moves now. And watching that show, there were some times where I would forget for just a few seconds, I would forget that I was not watching William Shatner as Captain Kirk, because his Captain Kirk was so close. All the camera stuff was so close. All the lighting was so close, where there'd be these moments where I would snap to it suddenly and be like, oh, wait, that's not William Shatner. And wow. And to me, like, that's the biggest compliment you can give that show. And so, I think that movies can immerse you. TV can immerse you in the same way that live theater does. Maybe even more effectively. depending on how well it's done.
Yeah, I mean, like, what were some of the complaints about, what was the show? There was something recently where somebody was like, had like a Starbucks in a thing, or they're like, had like a watch in a thing. That happens all the time. But when people catch it, it sucks. Like, it's like, I didn't need that. I didn't need that in my life. But like, you bring up about the lighting. That is something that people do not pay enough attention to. I mean, just most normies do not know how important lighting is, right? It's just, it's so incredible. Like, our show was shot almost entirely on like Canon SLRs, right? So like, we had everything on Canon SLRs, and I didn't know, like, I thought like, oh, that's just a camera that takes really nice photos. No. It takes really nice video and it looks like film. And I was like, but then I play with it and it doesn't look like film. And my director was like, no. It's all about the lighting. It's truly 100% about the lighting. And like, he took such detail that we had one window. We had one window on the side of the ring that sometimes that the fight would spill out and go by this window. And he would light this window just to make sure that the lighting was just even all the way through. And like, he would do things like, we had that one character named Drexel, who was the devil himself. And he'd have these like scenes and we'd just shoot them underneath the bleachers. And it was just this little like light. And it made it look like he was in this like little cramped hell of his own, just by the lighting that was set up there. And it's so funny. Cause like, how often have you watched the movie, The Truman Show?
I've watched it. I've seen it several times.
Okay. So like, you watch it and then like the Christoph character, he's all about like the lighting. Okay. And we're going to play this song right here. And we're going to do this right here. And it's just, it's like a little bit of a look behind the curtain of go ahead.
What's the first thing that Truman sees that starts to disassemble his reality?
Is the light falling down.
A light falls, and it's like, it's labeled Canis Minor, I think.
Sirius.
Yeah. And you know, that's where without the lighting, the image, the illusion starts to break apart.
Well, and like, I look at it this way. You know, for example, like in real life. So I kind of wanted to bridge this over from like the stage life to like what we're kind of witnessing right now in terms of like how they set the stage for the next narrative, the next thing that's coming, right? So for example, I remember in the first early days of the Biden presidency, right? And like, it was a little bit wonky and a little bit weird. And there were claims of like, this is not the Oval Office. This is a soundstage. Cause they're asking themselves like, look, man, like they had like within a day, they had all new carpet, all new wallpaper, all new stuff in the Oval Office. Like on the first day he's in there and he's signing off on his executive orders. And like, it was a little jarring. Right. Cause like, you're just like, hey man, like I thought that was supposed to be like, I mean, you know, give it some time, but no, they had it like immediately. Cause they had to put their stamp on it. Right.
It's like when you tune into season one of a show and they had a really, really small budget. And then in season two, they got that budget increase and they had all summer to kind of work on the sets and fix the little like bits and bobs and add some more stuff on there. And so you go from, you know, like this, the classic example in Star Trek, the Next Generation, there's this tea pedestal that sits behind Picard's chair. And in season one, it's just like beige. And in season two, they drew some black lines on it as if there's some panels that you can pull in and like futz around with little bits.
Makes all the difference though, right?
Yeah. It's one of those things where I didn't notice it for a long time, but now it's one of the things, it's one of the visual cues I use to catch, is this season one or is this, you know, season two onwards? Do those panels exist? And it does, it turns it from this like boring thing that's behind his head to that's a spaceship,
right?
Yeah,
well, and I think that like that's why they're doing a lot more of this stuff where like I really appreciate one of my favorite movie experiences of my life, and I think I mentioned this on our previous show, but one of my favorite experiences in the theater of my entire life, and it's not my favorite movie, by no means is it my favorite movie, but was the first time I ever saw Jurassic Park. Right. Mm-hmm. So the very first time I saw Jurassic Park, it blew my mind completely. I mean, it was like It was something else. It was completely immersive. It was the first time I ever saw like one with like Dolby Digital surround sound. So like hearing the T-Rex kind of behind you and kind of coming in from the side and stuff like that, it threw me off. Like that was really a big deal at the time. And then the same thing is that, like, you know, I remember I came out of that. I was like wondering, like, how did they do this? Cause like CGI wasn't really a big thing then. And they were wise about their CGI then because they didn't overdo it. They used a lot of practical effects that were, you know, like they used robots and they used puppets and they used all those kind of things. And it makes a difference.
And they only showed you just enough. They didn't go too far. Here's the Brontosaurus all standing up and look at how great they. All right, now we gotta get back to, because if you look too far at it, you'll see kind of past the curtain and start to go, oh, this looks like crap. And yeah, Hollywood has lost that, like, that subtle hand, that sandwich, like they would do sandwich shots, right, where they do like a close up right of a big robot T-Rex head, and then they go to a wide, and that's a CG, and then they come back to that close up real quick, and just enough to I see all the stuff. Jurassic Park is a phenomenal movie, and it's one of the other co-hosts on Here's What I Don't Get, Tim and I went and saw Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, I think that's the second one, and we went and saw it in 4D, and you know, 4D, you went and saw Jurassic Park in 1993 and had this amazing immersive experience, right? We went and saw Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom in 2018 2019 or something in 4D, super immersive, in these chairs that rocked, and there was like smells, and they were shooting, there were strobe lights. There were strobe lights to try and accentuate like the taser shots, but instead of being pointed at the audience because that would cause a seizure, they were pointed at the screen. So all they did was wash out the screen and just remind you of the fact that you were watching a movie. And I knew it was not going to be good at the very beginning, because when the logos were like fading in and they kind of swayed in, the chairs just rocked for absolutely no reason. And I started laughing immediately, and I was like, I'm trying to, theoretically, all this 4D is supposed to immerse me in the movie. I'm supposed to draw me into the movie. And none of that is as compelling as just having a story that is really, really exceptionally good.
Well, that's the thing, like this. I told you before, the last superhero movie I saw in the theater was the original Avengers movie.
Yes.
Right. And I saw it like that. I saw it with like the wonky seats and doing all that kind of stuff like that. And I didn't enjoy it. I thought I just didn't have fun. I didn't enjoy it. And then like everybody's like, oh, I can't wait till the next show. I'm like, really? Like, I guess, you know, like.
See, I had your Jurassic Park experience with that. Because Tim and I, Truckin' and Tuckin', a bunch of our other friends, we went to an all-day marathon. They started with the Iron Man from 2008. And they played all of the Marvel movies that had come out in order. And at midnight, we saw the 2012 Avengers film.
Okay.
And it was, so there's a moment in there, right, where they've defeated that first Goliath, that big flying monster thing. They've taken it out. It was, and there's this like huge cheer, and the crowd went crazy because we had been engaged in this world for the last, we started at 10 a.m. We're now 14 hours into our day. We are so engaged with this world. Like, we cheered, we're excited, we defeated the Goliath, and then two more come out of the portal in the sky. And you would think that we had all collectively seen our grandmother murdered on the stage in front of us. There was no sound at all. All of the air was sucked completely out of the room. And I have never felt that way in a crowd of people watching a movie ever again. I never felt it beforehand. I never felt it afterwards, because it was that perfect time, right? Smartphones were new. We weren't all dicking around on our phones. We were all watching movies for 14 hours. We were engaged. We were there to see that movie. And that's my Jurassic Park moment. That's the movie that I walked in. I walked into that movie not really a Marvel fan. I had seen a couple of them. I liked Iron Man. I walked out of that movie excited to see the next one because I had had such a great experience.
Interesting. And then, of course, but were the seats moving?
The seats weren't moving.
Okay,
it was just a movie.
Yeah. So for me, it was like a ride, right? So it was a ride. And every time that they were getting into an action sequence and stuff like that, I started being like, man, I don't want to move anymore. I just want to eat my popcorn. I just want to like enjoy this. Right. And like, one of the last movies I saw in the theater, cause I don't go to the theaters very much anymore at all. I remember early on, and here's what I don't get history when I was doing the show with Uncle Buck. I was really hard against the Star Wars series. I hate Disney Star Wars. I hate everything they've done. Every minute of footage they have put together, I hate it. Every single one of it. But like for a piece of time, I was like, I watched a Rogue One, like a ripped Rogue One video at my house. And I was like, you know what? Actually, I enjoyed a little, the exception is Rogue One. I enjoyed a little bit of Rogue One. You have to put your brain into a box and just kind of let it, like, you know, let people enjoy things, like that whole thing. Let people enjoy things. But I went to go and see it in the theater because I wanted to see if it still held up, because I kind of liked it at my house. I wanted to see it at the theater. And I went to one of those theaters that like is like all posh and like you got the lean back chairs and all this kind of stuff. It's like but I liked it because all of a sudden I was like, okay, I can just relax. I can just relax and immerse myself into the movie. Cause there's nothing worse than like, I don't know, back in the day, there's still theaters I'm sure out there that if you get stuck in the first three rows, like you're screwed. Like you're totally screwed. Cause you're like too close. You just can't get into it. I don't even know why they build those seats there.
I had a friend who had that happen during Oppenheimer, the new, I think it was literally row three. And they said that they spent the whole movie looking up at an angle and they walked out and their neck hurt and they did not enjoy the movie. And I said, yeah, that's why I don't go to the movie theater anymore. I've got a 75-inch screen TV. I've got a really nice sound system. I'll wait for it to come out on DVD.
Yeah. What's the point? Yeah. But going back to it though, a little bit, like the main thing that I did like about the movie theater was the audience, the being in the audience. So like, I don't know if I've told the story on the other show or not, but like in that experience of Jurassic Park. So I'm in line to go see the movie, just like those kids were at the Luchando thing. We were lined up around the building. And we were going to go see Jurassic Park. And I don't like know if you remember it very well, but it was, you were really young when
I didn't see it until it was on VHS. So my earliest memories of that movie are, you know, 4:3 on a tube TV, but even that to say the immersive, that movie could have been made with claymation. It didn't need CGI. It didn't need robots because the story is so good. You buy it. You'd buy it. If it was a man and a stick, you'd buy it.
Well, and like, so like there's sometimes like the, you had to be there moment. You know what I mean? Like the mm-hmm. you had to be there. Right. And so, you know, that's one of the things that I love about wrestling is if you see it live and you're there when a big moment happens, like it'll change you. Like it is a big deal. Right. Like, I mean, when you see a swerve, when you see, like, we're talking about sucking the air out of the room. Like we had four different what we call turns. So a heel turn is when a baby face, a good guy, turns bad. And then a face turn is when a bad guy turns good. And we only had one face turn in the whole show, but we had, I think, two heel turns. And the first heel turn was absolutely sucked the air completely out. No, we had three heel turns, but it sucked the air completely out of the room. And like you could just cut the tension with a knife, the betrayal that was feeling in that room. But like, that's the thing. When you set those emotions in place. So like, you know, when I go back and I try to look at like Spielberg films, and I try to look at it with a critical eye, not on the man, because I don't really like the man, Steven Spielberg. And I don't like all of his movies, but the ones that he did, he knows how to make you feel. He's a real emotional wizard. And so if he was, you know, like was, yeah. Like,
because his modern stuff lacks depth, I think.
Interesting. Well, like I saw somebody do a really good breakdown on how perfect. Okay. So going back to stage setup, blocking, the concept of blocking is a very big thing. So, you know, in the wrestling world, for example, if we're going to do a major move and it's being televised for an audience at home, you got to make sure you do it in the part of the ring that the camera will see it. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's a really important thing. You got to make sure the referee's not in the way. You got to wake me, like me as a manager on the outside of the ring, I got to make sure I'm out of the way. Right. I got to make sure everybody sees it. I go in when it's my time. I stay out of the way when it's not my time. But like, Steven Spielberg's, his blocking is phenomenal. And there's actually a show I really want to get my hands on. It was a BBC show from the 70s starring Patrick Stewart called I, Claudius. And apparently I, Claudius is one of the greatest shows that the BBC ever did. And the whole thing is basically set up like a stage play. Right. So their stages, like BBC did not have an endless budget then. And so all of their shows were shot in studio on these little sound stages. And the director of this show had that it factor on blocking. So he knows when to like zoom in on somebody's face. He knows when to back out and track the person walking along the room and having, you know, sometimes you're tracking somebody and the guy's walking, but like, for example, like the, in the Empire, like the, in Star Wars, right? When the Emperor and Darth Vader are walking, how that is set with the camera about when they're walking in front of all the stormtroopers, it really kind of adds that like, oh no, like these guys are really like, they're organized. They're militant. They're ready to go. That's the thing that Spielberg had. And so going back to like that moment, I mean, prior to Jurassic Park, the first one, not a lot of people know this, but the trailers showed nothing. There was nothing. There was no, we got nothing. We got no, we never saw a single dinosaur on the trailers. All you saw was that famous logo of Jurassic Park, black with the yellow and the red, and that was it. Mm-hmm. And so when we were waiting to go into this movie, we had no idea what we were going to see. We didn't even know we were going to see a horror film. And or a thriller, I mean, whatever you want to call it. But like, I was with my best friend, Jeff, and we were in line and we spotted two girls that we went to school with, Jody and Justine. And they were cute girls, but they were kind of like the nerdy hipster girls, right? And like, it was like, you know, like, whoa, we know you. Hey, we know you. And then like, hey, come with us. And they cut the line. They come with us and like, hey, we're going to sit with Justine and Jody. This is great. And like, we get into the movie theater and we sit down, we get great seats. And like, I'll still remember like looking over at like the girls' reactions to the show too. Like Jody had her legs up. She was just like, she did not want to look at the screen at all. She was terrified. And that's the thing that movie did. It had jump scares, but it also had that like uneasy, like lingering, like, oh crap, something is going to come at any moment. Like, you know, just the whole idea, like the power's out. Right, the power's out. We don't have and then it's like a cut to like, the fence is broken. You know, like the wired fence is now broken. It's like, it got out. And so like it had this tension building and building and building. And that's the thing, even in the wrestling world right now, is missing. And when I get Sully on in a future episode of this, we're gonna talk about that, because the thing is like, you got to tell a story. And you said yourself, like it's about storytelling. It's about character building. And that's something that's missing from a lot of the movies.
So you sent me a couple weeks ago, maybe a month ago, you sent me some stuff about Hulk Hogan facing Andre the Giant.
And
I had never seen it. I had never seen it. And so it's like an 11 or 12 minute match. Right. And I have no best interest in Andre the Giant or Hulk Hogan.
Right.
And I watched it. And I was captivated, right? It was it was a really interesting match. And of course, I know it's fake. And I think part of it, before you sent me the full match, you had sent me some interviews of people talking about the match.
Yes.
And then I watched the match. But it had that great tension. They were telling a story. There was something there that was more than just they weren't just fighting. And no. In wrestling today, I don't claim to be an expert about wrestling, but I've been backstage at wrestling events.
Mm-hmm.
You know that John Cena is not going to lose. You know he's not going to turn bad, and you know he's not going to lose because it's too safe. It's a very safe thing. And that's fine. And the audience likes it. So I've worked WWE several times on crew in the arenas. And I remember the first one that I did was in 2012 or 2015. And all I did was load in.
Okay. Yeah.
Loaded in, loaded out.
Yeah.
No, I had no vested interest. I went in and did my job and I left.
Okay. But
then in 2021, I wasn't on crew. I was managing the crew. I was the steward, but I was in a position where I could kind of watch the show, and I hadn't been able to watch the show before. And I was watching the show, so let me preface that story by also saying I've worked in live music for basically my entire life. My dad's a musician. He's been playing out live since I was a kid. I've helped him load in concerts. I have seen him play 1,000 times, and I would see him play 1,000 times more. I've seen him play to a huge VH1 live out onto television in front of a giant crowd in downtown Tulsa. I've seen him play a battle of bands across the country. I've seen him play to a dinner setting with a dozen people, myself included. And every single one of them was the show. It was just my favorite show I've ever seen.
That's awesome.
And so I've worked in live music, and I work with this guy that I've become very close friends with. He's from a different world than you and I. He is a very excitable, interesting guy. And I love working with him because he can kind of see past the veil. He sees not what it is, but what it could be. And he will feed to what it can be. So he'll live with what it is, but he won't say, well, this is what we are. We're just this little shit band. He wants it to be what he can see in his mind. And so he really pushes the people around him. And we've had all these conversations over the years about energy and in live music, this energy where you're playing and the audience is there and they like feed into the performers and the performers feed out in the audience. And there's this like tangible energy that flows from a crowd and a performer. And I haven't seen it as much in live theater as I have in live music. And I think because music like engages our brains in a much different way, but I have seen it in wrestling. So I'm standing backstage at WWE and I'm watching these wrestling matches happen.
Quick question. Was it a TV taping or just a house show?
I think it was a TV taping. It was a TV taping.
Okay.
I only know that because we charge them a different rate when it's a TV taping. I'm standing there kind of in the wings where I can't be seen, but I can kind of see what's going on in the ring. And I've loved my whole career. I love watching the audience. I've seen the show 100 times. Most of the time I have not seen the audience. So I like kind of being peering around, especially those big moments in the show. And I like to kind of look over and see where, oh my God, the plot has changed immensely now. And I like to see those reactions on people's faces. And so I'm very much like, sometimes when I'm not at a front of house position, I'll find a place where I can see the audience from a vantage point in the wings, because I like to feel that energy. And I could see that watching WWE. Everybody knows it's fake. It doesn't matter. It's fun. It's fun. Just let people have their fun, and they engage with it. And it's really, I left the first WWE I did in 2021. I left that kind of being not a wrestling fan, but I got it a little bit more than I had before, because I didn't get it before.
It's one of the last great American live. It's a lot like jazz. Okay. So a lot of people don't realize it, but it's a lot like jazz, because the thing is that you have to read the room. And if it's time to change the tempo, change the tempo. And if it's not time to change the tempo, or like we'll change the ending of a match based on how the crowd is reacting. And like when you talk about how you plan out your theater schedule, we had our entire storyline mapped out all the way from the very first taping all the way to the last taping. And it changed a bunch of times based on fan feedback. And so like we had the story of Luchando is the story of a guy named Blas Benitez. And if he spoke a word of English, I would have him on the show in a heartbeat. But the thing is like the story of Blas Benitez was he was talking about staging, setting the stage for what it was. We made a big deal out of doing publicity before our first taping. So we actually reached out to like the Paraguayan Cultural Association, the Paraguayan Sporting Association. We held a press conference. And then at the press conference, I'm there and I'm the owner of the company. I'm introducing these people we brought in from abroad. But what we did is we seeded in that press conference where I was a little bit more complimentary to the North American talent than I was to the local guys. Just a little bit more complimentary, like putting them over a little bit more than the others. And so what we had is finally the one guy like snaps at the press conference. And we have in Paraguay, they one of the popular drinks here, the most popular drink here is something called tereré. And tereré it's yerba mate tea, but it's like served cold. So you put it in like this little metal cup and you pour your ice water over top of it. And you've got a metal straw in it with like a filter at the bottom and you sip it out of there. So we actually had one of these sitting on the table. And then like, as this thing was building up and you could see, and we'd have the camera just pan over and just like, look at the faces and the guys are happy. And this guy's like a little bit off. And so finally we had him snap and he gets up and he gets pissed off and he throws this tereré like mate onto the North American wrestler that we brought in. And we had, so that North American wrestler that we brought in, Scotty Mack, was our top baby face. And we played him up as our top baby face. He's this blonde hair, blue eyed guy. And we put him on this, on like front and center on everything. But then what we did is we had Blas Benitez come out and interrupt his match and just like shout at him and stuff like that. So we're planting in everybody's heads, this is the bad guy. This is the bad guy, right? And he's upset. He doesn't, why are you giving him more opportunity than me? Blah, 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 blah. And that's when my character came in. My character, Don Chaco, was in the VIP booth. I like the cut of your jib. I like the fact that you want what you want and you're going to go and take it. So I hire that guy up. He's my first wrestler to my group, the Dynasty. So we bring him up on stage and everybody's booing because I just insulted the crowd. I insulted the crowd by basically playing into the stereotypes. My first thing I do is I'm in the VIP booth. The guy, the announcer comes over to interview some of the actual VIPs. We had some like Paraguayan models that were famous here in the VIP booth with me. And I just snatched the microphone from his hand, pop over and go up on the stage. And the security goes to stop me and I bribe him. And then he lets me go up on stage. Right. And like, these are all things that people know to do. You bribe all over the place here. But the fact that this foreigner is doing it and taking control of the show and has no qualms about it is fine. Like, sorry, is not going over well with people. They're really mad. So I go up there and I say to them, I'm here to buy three things. I'm here to buy your cheap land, your cheap love, and your championship, right? And I'm going to buy your best wrestler. So I call up this guy who's the best wrestler in Paraguay, and he's on my team. And then I go and I get Sully, who's the biggest guy in the company, and then I get the best female wrestler in the company on my side. So now I'm stacked. My team is unbeatable. I'm the Goliath, right? Like we're the unbeatables. And we cheat and we do all types of stuff and it never works out in our favor. But slowly but surely, our first heel turn was Scotty Mack. Scotty Mack didn't think that the crowd respected him enough. Scotty Mack didn't think that they were cheering loud enough for him. Right. And so he's a bad guy now. And then I've got my bad guys. And then we did a tournament all the way up to this title match. And in the very first title match, It's my two guys were the top of the tournament. So what we did is we basically made it so that it was my guy versus my guy. But because it was a Paraguayan versus an American, I then took the time to say to my Paraguayan guy, like, you did good. You did good. You know, like, great job. Like, you know, Paraguay's never had a champion in this country, but tonight neither. I need you to take a dive. Right. Like, I need you to take a dive. And, you know, so the thing that I did is I made it so that I could get that audience to feel. And when we were writing the lines for this thing, right, like the go home line on this one was, so it was passed to me. It was like, you're going to say, and you're nothing but a stupid Paraguayan. And I looked at that and I pushed it back and I was like, no, I'm not doing that one. And they're like, why? That'll get the heat. And I'm like, it's the wrong kind of heat. It's the wrong kind of heat. And he's like, why not? And I'm like, well, yeah, they're going to hate you. I'm like, yeah, but we're also going to be broadcasting this in El Salvador, in Chile, in Bolivia. They might think Paraguayans are stupid. You know, I don't think Paraguayans are stupid, but they might. And I don't want to play into that. I need something that resonates with everybody. So I changed the line simply to, you're nothing but a stupid employee. So do what I say and take the dive. And so his face turn was him popping me. And it was the first time we saved it the whole time. The first time I got punched was by that guy. The crowd went bananas. They went absolutely berserk. So we had this first match and it looks like he's going to win. He's just like, I mean, what, like it's basically where Sullivan has this chain that he uses as his weapon. We've knocked down the ref. Cause like a ref bump is key to doing something. The ref's got the ref in wrestling has the best job ever because like he loves his work so much that even though he's been knocked unconscious, probably has a concussion, he still finishes the job and gets the three count. Right. But so we had it. So that basically Sullivan goes to get his chain, goes to hit Bloss. He gets hit. Bloss reverses it on him. He pops him down. Sully's down on the ground. It's now over. He's going to get the three count, but the ref's still out. And in comes Scotty Mack, the guy who was the heel. He comes in and he's still got a beef with Bloss, and Bloss still has a beef with him because of the beginning with the press conference. He super kicks him out. He goes, I grab up, and the crowd is now just like air has been sucked out of the room completely. And I just kind of saunter into the ring, kind of looking to make sure it's okay. I grab the chain. I wake up Sully. I give him the chain. I go and I wake up the referee. Sully comes over, pops him one more time with the chain, pins him, pulls his tights to make it even worse. And then 1, 2, 3, and we win. And the crowd was livid, absolutely livid. But I'll never forget because we went through and that was midpoint in the season. And then the rest of the season was chasing the big bad, chasing the dragon all the way to the end. And when we got down to that final match where finally Bloss got the contract, because like I was trying to prevent him from getting the contract to get it. And he gets the contract to finally get the chance to fight Sullivan again. And the crowd was legitimately, I mean, you said like people know it's fake, but they're like, but you broke our hearts before, you could probably break our hearts again. Yeah. And so like we had it in the thing where I come in to interfere and it gets reversed and I get splashed in the corner by a big 450-pound man and I fall out of the ring and then they carry on for the rest of the match. And I'll never forget it because I was laying on the outside of the ring. I had my Don Chaco hat on. I had my sunglasses on. I had it just tilted over my eyes, but I was able to look the entire time at the crowd. And while I'm looking at the crowd, I'm watching the emotion on that crowd because I'm looking at this and I'm thinking to myself on this journey that we came on, all the way through the fact that I almost didn't have this show happen. The fact that we went through so many adversities, we were on our third TV station by the end of it, but cause we kept going and we're trying to get those sponsors to keep it going. But when it really came down to it, I'm watching for the fans' sake, I'm looking up the crowd and it was the most emotional moment of my entire creative career. I'm watching the crowd go. I hear the 1, 2, 3 when Blas Benitez finally gets the win over Sullivan, and the crowd, not a single face, not a single person in the crowd wasn't crying. They were just pouring pouring tears and just so happy. They were partying for over an hour afterwards. We had the whole thing set up with pyro and confetti comes from this thing, and he goes into the crowd and they're carrying him. And it was so magical. And the whole thing came about because of proper character build. Now, you brought up about how John Cena always wins, and that's safe, right? That's safe to make Blas Benitez lose earlier on. That's not safe. That was a risk. Yeah. And then on top of it, we have in WWE now, they have what's called 50-50 booking, because they're trying to asset manage as much as they can to make sure that you don't make anybody look too strong or make anybody look too weak. And so if there's a guy's having a feud, this guy wins this week, that guy wins the next week, and just back and forth, back and forth. Whereas going back to Andre the Giant and Hulk Hogan, they played up the whole thing that Andre the Giant's never lost. And even though he had been body slammed before, they played it up like nobody's ever been able to slam him.
Well, there's that moment in that Andre the Giant Hulk Hogan fight. This is I think where I came around watching it for the first time.
Right.
Right. He's being like Cobra bear hugged by Andre the Giant, right?
Yeah. And the life's going out of him.
The life's going out of him, and the crowd is like is chanting his name, and the referee takes his arm and lifts it up and lets it go, and it droops.
Yeah.
And he picks it up and lets it go again. And then on the thing, they're like, oh, if he doesn't come out of this one, they're gonna call it right here now. And he pulls up his arm and lets it go, and Hulk Hogan's arm stays up, and I was like, yeah! Watching it on YouTube,
and it drops too. His elbow goes down to here, and he comes back up with it. That was a spot that Hulk Hogan stole from Dusty Rhodes, but Dusty Rhodes never got that reaction, not to that level. And
fun. It's fun. It's captivating. It's drama, and that's what people love. I don't want to turn this around on you, but sure. Do you feel like you were manipulating the audience in the story that you were telling?
Absolutely. That was the point. Yeah. That was the point. And, we had to. We did it, and it's a science. You can't go too far, because they'll just turn off. There's what we call heat, right? So like as a manager, my job was to be a heat magnet, right? So go back to that Andre the Giant match, and he comes out with Bobby the Brain Heenan, right? Mm-hmm. Now normally Bobby the Brain Heenan is involved, he'll do something that'll he'll interfere or do something, but not in that match, because that was a big fight feel. He comes in a suit, he comes in a white suit, and he comes out to the ring with him and stuff. But keep in mind, now this is the thing, a lot of people don't realize is how bad Andre the Giant was at that. His condition was so bad. Yeah. He could barely stand, right? That bear hug moment was written in because he couldn't do anything. Right?
And Hulk Hogan is standing on his tiptoes to try and keep him from having to bend too much. That was that, watching that whole the behind the scenes and watching that match. That's theater, man. It's a different venue. It's a different shape of stage, but it's a theater. And I personally I've come around on that, on wrestling as an art form. I would not scoff at the opportunity to work in that realm.
I think you'd be fantastic in that realm, to be honest with you. I think not only do I think you could be a good manager like myself, but I think you could also be a really good wrestler. I said this to you before. I sent your glass blowing photo over to my buddy Sully, and I was like, yeah, man, I think he's 6'2", 6'4". I think he could work. He's like, yeah, I could train him. So
I wanna hyphenate that by the discussion which led to that conversation happening, because Tim and Truckin' and Tuckin', my two best friends in the world.
Yeah.
And we went down this whole rabbit hole trying to figure out exactly how tall John Cena is, because we both ran into John Cena backstage during WWE, face to face. Excuse me, Mr. John Cena, I didn't see you there, kind of thing. And not just Truckin' and Tuckin' and I, but many other stagehands. And everyone said the same thing, which was John Cena is shockingly small.
Yep. Yep.
And so our guest was somewhere around 5'6", maybe 5'8".
No, he couldn't be that slow as well.
Yeah, all the stuff says that he's 6 feet tall, but he's actually 5'10" and says he's 6 feet tall. And so we're going through all these like pictures of him next to other celebrities trying to figure out exactly how tall he is, because I've been face to face with the man and he doesn't come to my chin.
Weird.
And so I was, I reached out to the only person I know who knows anything about wrestling. And I was like, what is going on here? And that was why you sent the photo of me to someone else and said like, oh, right. This guy's, cause you said, oh, we'll bill him as 6'7". And I was like, that's crazy.
Well, see, this is the thing. So like, you know, it depends on how mobile the guy is, right? Like, it depends on how mobile the guy is. But think about it this way. You can, in theory, put 3 inches of foam underneath. Two, like, one is safe. Two is pushing it. Three, you're, like, really pushing it. Mm-hmm. And then inside the boot, you can put another 2 to 3 inches of a lift inside the boot as well. So you're basically like walking around like Kiss, you know, like.
So the CEO of the company I worked for in Tulsa before I started managing the stagehands.
Yeah.
He was an actor and he was not a tall man. So I'm 6'2". I'm like just straight up. That's how tall I am. And
right.
I've never taken pride in being tall, because I think it's weird to be proud of a thing that you have no control over.
Right.
And so I had worked with this guy outside of the company that I ended up working for him for many years. And I had never put together that he wears lifts. But one day he came and sat in my office, and the company was changing management. And he was staying in charge, but we were changing like corporate structuring stuff. And he wanted to come down and be like, you know, I'm just one of the guys sitting here in the tech office with all you like hourly employees who are normal guys. And I'm sitting there talking. He's doing the thing where he kind of like perches on your desk, you know? And he's perched on my coworker's desk, but he kind of perches and crosses his legs. When he crosses his legs, I saw the lacing of his shoes. And I realized he's wearing lifts. He wears lifts 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because even with his lifts, he's only about 6 feet tall, just to be that 6 feet tall, because he's an actor. He's always been an actor. And he had to have a double hip replacement because he could not live with being 5'8" or whatever the height was.
It's the male equivalent of a push-up bra, right?
It is exactly
a push-up bra.
And right, it's just to create a facade. It's one thing to create a facade on stage, but like he's trying to create a facade in his real life of being a tall guy. Nobody cares. Nobody cares, apparently, but yeah.
No, and that's the thing. Like, we have this character that we're contemplating bringing back for nostalgia purposes, which is like the Mummy. And like, when it got put on our desk, we're like, you know, like we got to find a way to book this guy, the Mummy. And it's like, it's terrible. It's a terrible gimmick. It doesn't work out well and everything like that. But it's like, well, you know, how do we make it work if we have to make it work? So it was like, yeah, we got to make this thing as tall as can be. Let's take our tallest guy, put the tallest lifts in it, make him as tall as possible. And they're like, well, it'll cut down on his movement. I'm like, great. He's a mummy. I don't want him moving a lot. I want him standing in the middle of the ring and just being like, you know, like hard to move around.
Moaning noises.
Yeah. Well, and it's really weird though. Like, yeah, I got to meet the ex-comedian Owen Benjamin at one point in time, right? And like, the guy talks about it all the time about how tall he is. And I mean, I'm not saying he's not tall, right? Like, I'm not saying he's not tall, but he bills himself as like 6'8" or 6'7". And it's like, I've been around people who are 6'8", 6'7". You ain't it, right? Because like, you know, 6'4" tops. Because the thing is that like, I look at my own photo, I'm 6 feet on the button, like, right. Like, you know, just like I'm 6 foot and like a half an inch. Right. And like, I know my height and like, I'm standing next to him and I've been around, like, I had a cousin who's 6 foot. I think he's 6'5" or 6'6". And like, the height difference wasn't like that. Like, and like, actually my height came to a disadvantage in wrestling because I can't work with shorter wrestlers because I make them look small. right? Yeah. So I have to work with big guys. I have to. If I work with a small guy, I can, but I got to spend my time far away from him in the ring so that nobody gets that like impression. And when I come in to talk to him, I bend and I like, you know, I shake his hand. I'm like bowing down, you know, doing something to play with that height.
That was the craziest thing in the WWE filmings that I was working on, was that I can't show this because, you know, audio format, but there were backstage ring girl. I don't think they're ring girls. They were like post interview girls, right?
Okay.
And very attractive women. And so they had all these like backstage areas set up, right? They have the arena. The arena has the ring. It has the like big video wall where they walk out of their area. But then backstage in the back hallways, they have a couple of different areas set up for post show interviews.
Right.
I guess I don't know what the difference is between them, but the women were all extremely attractive. And all of them, not flats. A one of them, flat. Yeah, they're all wearing flats, which is really odd because I've, you know, most women in those kinds of settings, they're in some kind of heels. So they're all in flats, which is kind of odd. But there was one that I walked past the backstage interview going on during the show, and she was standing, you know, most people stand with their feet kind of shoulder width apart, a nice comfortable level.
She was like an A-frame.
Was an A-frame. She was almost doing the splits so that her head was just a few inches below the guy's head so that he looked like a bigger dude. And I was shook. I was shook.
Well, and see, the funny thing is, like, when I worked in midget wrestling, I remember when I came to Short Sleeve Samson about it, and I was like, hey, man, you know, I think there's a fit. Right. And like, I pitched it to him because I was like, you know, I worked with him on a couple of other shows. We really hit it off. And I was like, you know, man, you're going to be in Calgary and I'm moving back to Calgary. And when you come to Calgary, I'll do shows with you there. And because he liked my work. And I was like, and at first I was like, but like, I'm like too tall than all these other guys. But then we realized, we're like, no, that's perfect.
That makes it better.
That's perfect. Because you want them to look even smaller. Right. The smaller they are, the more money they draw. Mm-hmm. And so then on top of it, if I'm going out there as a tall guy, and we had a spot all the time where like I interfere with Samson and he pops out of the ring and he chases me around the ring and it looks hilarious. It looks hilarious. And every time I'm like cowering and doing all this kind of stuff like that to these guys, it works out great. And it you know, so it's set and setting. It's all about the pacing, the staging, the blocking, and all that kind of stuff. But it turned out really well in the end. But I wanted to kind of, like, I know we're an hour and 20 minutes into this thing, and I wanted to just kind of loosely kind of play what we know about setting the stage, about presentation, and see if there's anything that you're seeing now in, like, the news that is, like, you know, kind of being prepped ahead of time. Because, like, one of the things that I like to say with my wife is, like, you know, we're not prophets. We're just kind of reading the reading motions. The yeah. And, like, you know, I was able to call it, like, in Canada, I was able to call it to the month. To the month. We made the decision in May, announced to our friends in June, got ready to put the house up for sale, and sold the house in July. And moved down here at the end of July. But I said to everybody, and they were like, oh, they lifted all the restrictions and there's not going to be any, you know, like it's over. And I'm like, it's not over. It's not over at all. They're going to bring it back in the fall. And it's just going to be all over again. And then I said, we have to get out now while we still can, while I can still fly. Right. And they're like, oh, they're not going to block you from flying. Like, no airline would ever like block you from flying. I was like, it's not going to be the airlines that are going to do it. They'll be the muscle.
I disagree.
But they're not.
You.
No,
I think the airlines would do it. Well,
no. But the thought that we had was that there would be one airline that wouldn't, and there'd be another one that would, and you just pick the one that, you know, like you could fly on.
Yeah.
But like, I was like, no, dude, it's going to be across the board. By the government. They're going to be like, well, our hands are tied. The government told us we have to do this. And that was going to be the way it was going to go. And it was to the month. They announced it at the end of August. It got put it got like soft put in September, and then it was hard put in October. And that was it. And it was in there for months and months and months. And I remember I was devastated. Even though I knew it was coming, I was devastated. The reason why I was devastated was because right.
It sucks so much being right, man. It sucks so much being right.
About those kind of things? Yeah, absolutely.
About everything. I hate being right all the time. It's my biggest it causes me self-loathing. My ability to be right about things and to call the shots ahead of time, it causes me self-loathing because I would love to be a stupid idiot that is wrong all the time. It's like, oh yeah, right. They're going to bring back the pandemic for the 2024 presidential election. What a big dummy he was. What a big dummy Tab is. But now they're like, we might need to bring back masks for the fall in 2023. And I'm like, no.
Yeah.
Why?
But you can see the pacing.
Yeah.
Right. Where was the first time I heard about it? Somebody shares with me a video of Alex Jones telling about some like tip that he got, and nobody wants to give him credit. I don't enjoy getting any information from Alex Jones because I can't share that with anybody. I got to take it with a grain of salt.
That's the thing, right? So he's saying mask mandates will be back late September. Even if he's right. I can't walk into my work and be like, hey, check out this Alex Jones video where he said that this was from mid-August when he said that by October 1st, we would be back in masks. Check that out. And then you watch Alex Jones? No,
no, no.
He was
no,
right. No, but you're not listening. Yeah, you're not listening to the thing.
Nope. And that's the thing. So then what happens is you get what's called like push pulls, right? So this is something that like, I think his name is like Frank Lutz or something Lutz. He used to do all the time. And it's like, so polls are very important for setting the stage for something. Mm-hmm. It's not gauging the public's opinion. It's pushing the public's opinion because you're making it seem like everybody else thinks this one way. And you're like, well, that doesn't sound right. But like, no, but look at the polls. And then like the way they frame the polls. So they'll say like, for example, it's like, you know, I saw a poll. It was like, you know, in Vancouver or it was British Columbia. And they're like, a third of British Columbians want to bring back the mandates. And it's like, but two thirds of them don't. Right. Like yeah. two thirds of them don't. And like, you're just not framing it the way that it would be.
Polls are a scam, too, because the question may not be Chaco. Do you want to bring back mask mandates and not letting people go back to work and you can't go like to the grocery store once a day? That's not the question. The question is, would you support more stringent? Would you support going back to measures to prevent the spread of disease? It's something so vague that a third of people are so stupid that they'll say, well, I don't like disease. Yeah, if there's something we could do to stop disease, I'd go for that. And then there's a third of people that say, no, fuck you. Go jump off a cliff. I hate you. Then there's a third of people for whatever reason say, I don't know. I don't know. And then there's 10%.
It's always that third. It's the mushy third that they're trying to move.
Then right, there's 10% of people that say, I won't accept your polls. Please stop contacting me. And those are the people that we have to support.
Yes. But I've seen it where it's like they'll like post a hypothetical. They're like, well, if a more dangerous variant were to hit Canada.
Yes.
Right. And then lo and behold, like after the polls come on, there's been a new case in Winnipeg.
And then they take it as like a commitment. You said that if a more dangerous one came, you'd do it. And now it's here.
And if you're against it, you're some sort of a horrible person and you don't care about grandma and you're a conspiracy theorist. And like, you know, that's such a powerful wizard word to say. You know, like it shuts everything down. Oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. It's over.
Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Exactly. But like, you see these certain things, and like everything is a photo op, everything is set up. And so the name of this show is High Trust, Low Context. It's going to take me a while to even memorize the name of my own show, but like one of the things, and this is a question I really wanted to ask you, and I'm going to try to ask every guest that comes on the show. At this stage in your life, who and what do you still trust?
I trust my family, my Yilmath. Yilmath is the word. When Truckin' and Tuckin' and Tim the Handlebreaker and I watched Fast 9 for the first time, this is going to be a really weird story, but please bear with me.
I'll let you go with it.
When we watched Fast 9 for the first time, the ninth movie in the Fast and Furious franchise, they introduced John Cena, who is a wrestler.
Yeah.
It's all tying together. It's all tying together. I swear this makes sense at the end.
I trust you, man. Take on feel.
I'm not talking. I'm to your listeners. Your listeners are probably going to say this is insanity. This man is insane. So
if you're still around at this point, they're sticking
John
with
Cena. John Cena is introduced as Dom's brother, who is working for evil. So we were having a great time. We were doing our movie nights. We were drinking and carrying on. And one of the fun things of our movie nights is that we were kind of riff tracking. We would make fun of the movie that was happening. So, of course, if you've watched the Fast and Furious movies, Dominic Toretto, he believes in family. So if his brother is the evil twin, he must believe in Yilmath, which is family backwards. And so the whole movie, every time John Cena comes up, if we're not playing the John Cena entrance music for our own entertainment, we're like joking about how he believes in Yilmath. But fast forward a few years, and I needed to find, I've worked in theater my entire life, and I've worked with a lot of employers that tell you we're family, and I hate that. Like, I've been interviewing for some new technicians, and I will not say that our crew is family. Now, do I believe that my crew is a tightly integrated unit of people that care for one another? Yes. Is that a lot like family? Yes. But I will not say that my crew is family, because in my experience, when someone says, our crew is, our business isn't really a business, we're more like a family, what the person is doing is they're trying to exploit you. They're trying to trick
unearned loyalty.
Yes, you nailed it. They want you to, because if something happened to your sister or your brother or your father or your mother, you would drop everything to
absolutely
help them. Because that's what family is. Yeah. But there's something beyond family, right? There are those people that are like that. We have those people in our lives where we would drop everything because they're family, but they're not biological family. So I created this. I started to adopt the word of Yilmath, my family backwards, to describe these people that if Tim the Handlebreaker, something happened to Tim the Handlebreaker, there is no force in the world that would keep me where I was if Tim wasn't there, because he is the closest thing to a brother that I have in the world, having no biological brothers. If something were happening to my friend Truckin' and Tuckin', I would not stop to help him. My mentors in my career, they are to me as strong as a biological family member was. Some of them are like secondary fathers, and that comes from someone who has in the greatest father in the world. And I'll fight you if you want to argue. You know, I'm not one of the, there are a lot of guys that will say that with someone's their surrogate father because they had a shitty father. Like, I have an amazing father, but I still look to some of these men that I've had as mentors in my life as additional fathers, because they were the right age demographic, because they like depose something onto me. So the things that I trust in this world are those people. And I had a much larger group of those people 5 years ago. That group has really thinned in the intervening years as we've learned the true honesty of our friends and our brothers. And I'm extremely, extremely fortunate that two of my brothers before that time are still there. A lot of them are new. A lot of them are like they're secondary Yilmath. They're like second cousins, right? Where I love them, I trust them, I'll take care of them. I will do my part because I am compelled by my honor to do it. But I don't know if I trust them the same way that I trust Tim and Trucking and Tucking and my dad. Like those are the three. Those are the three men in this world that when the time comes to put a gun in someone's hand to watch your back, that's who I'm putting a gun in their hand. And that's my level of trust. Like that's the line. Would I arm you to watch my back? And it's a weird line, and it's something that's hard to explain to people who aren't gun guys, who aren't family guys, but that's my like insane conspiracy paranoid brain, truly honest level of who I would choose. And El Chaco, I would count you among those. The only reason why I wouldn't put a gun in your hand is because I don't foresee a world where you and I are in the same geographical location to fight the globalists.
You're speaking too fast. You don't count out Paraguay just yet. There could be a time.
I don't not see a world where I live in Paraguay someday, but
it may not be Norway. I know you want to go to Norway, but like, you know, I would, you would have a clean bed and I'd have access some meal to our food and all that. Yeah. You'd be taken care of. And it's interesting because you bring up about the people that were in your tight circle that weren't afterwards. And I feel like after all of us have kind of come through this trauma, and it was a trauma, it's still a trauma. We're still kind of not still wrapping our heads around what exactly is happening and has happened. And it's probably going to get worse before it gets better. Sorry, but it is. But I was saying that I was talking about this with my wife about even just the concept of trust and how you almost have to learn how and when to distrust before you can learn how to trust. And coming through what you did, and you had your friends that you thought were tight, and then they showed their true colors, they did you a favor. And they did you a favor because in the end, you have a better idea now of what areas of distrust you were lacking and where you can poke holes in those things. Because like you got to learn how to be able to who to trust and how not and like who not to trust. And go ahead.
I think that's one of my major failings because I'm despite being a very like closed and private person, I have this, you know, hymen of trust where once you're kind of through it, and there are levels inside of there, but yeah, I'm very quick to build a bond with people.
Yeah.
And because I want to live in a world where we all look out for one another. And so
a high trust society,
I want to live in a high trust society. Yes. That's where I want to be. And so I just keep putting myself out there. I just keep saying like, maybe this time will be different. And so it's almost a personal failing of probably trusting the wrong people. And so like, I can see it in my head, in my like logical brain. I can see that I am maybe making poor choices of associations and trust and yield.
You're learning. You're still learning, man. Like you're still compiling information. That's about fair. People. And like, for example, in my conversion story, like when I was coming back to the church, when we were first moved back to Calgary, I grew up in a different Calgary. Calgary was a very different place. And, you know, it demographically was different. it economically was different. And it just in general was a different place growing up. And one of the things that I always likened, when I think of a high trust society, I saw a video the other day. It was a TikTok video of this lady in, I think she was in Maine. It's just some small town in Maine. And the video is point of view. You live in this small town in Maine. And it's this lady, this blonde lady walking down the street, and she comes up and there's a stand. And on the stand is a bunch of different potted flowers, and they're for sale. And there's a jar on the stand, and it's got money in it. And you leave some money and you take a flower and you go and you walk away. And now that seems so like fake to most people. Like when you live in the city and you live in these different places, it seems so outlandish. It seems so staged and fake, but those things are real. I've seen entire supermarkets. I've driven into places where you go and there's like a farmer's market, but the farmer's market is literally at the edge of the farmer's field, and he's got a stand set up, and he's got tomatoes and he's got cucumbers. He's got all these things and the prices are there, and he's got a thing, and you just leave the money that you gave, and it's on an honor system. And the thing is that is achievable again, but like, we're not going to get there. We're not going to get there under these circumstances. And like when I got back to Calgary, because like when I was growing up in Calgary, the moment things changed for me, and I'll probably bring this up in the series over and over again, but the moment things changed for me was when I had to lock my bike. So when I was a kid, I had a elementary school. I had two elementary schools we could go to. There was a Catholic school and the public school, and I went to both. So I started in the Catholic school and I ended up switching over to the public school. But when I was, so my parents would trust that we could walk all the way. It was like a 10, 15 minute walk to the school by ourselves. And I did it. I'm like, I think I was like in the second grade or first grade when I was like walking myself to school and like, you know, walk all the way. And there's cars that come along and all that kind of stuff, but it was safe. And you could walk to school. And then to cut down on the time, I would bring my bike. And then you'd take the bike, and the bike had bike racks. And very few people actually locked their bike. Like the fact that anybody, it was a time where actually it was almost like cool to have a bike lock, because not everybody had a bike lock, right? Like it wasn't necessary. And so you would just put your bike on the bike rack and then go into the school. Like who's going to steal a bike from a child in a school? You come back out and you take the bike and you go home. And then I switched over to the public school system. And at a certain point in time, the city started a new initiative. And it's this idea of like learning by osmosis. If you put low trust people in a high trust society, maybe they'll turn into what their surroundings are like. And it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way at all. So they put this group home for troubled kids across the schoolyard from us. I'll never forget it. There were three kids that were in my grade that came in. I forget the girl's name, but there was Lee and
Harper.
I forget his name. There's two of them. The two of them, and they were bad. Like we had bullies and we had like fights and we had all those kind of things, but we didn't have anything like these guys. Right. And these guys came and it was like, everything changed. Like I was in grade six and like, I remember I used to, you know, those Panini sticker books that come out like, so Panini,
I don't.
Panini's a brand. And so what they would do is like, you could get sticker books of like hockey teams or, it was like, think of like trading cards, but like stickers, okay. Right? And you get these packs of the stickers, you open them up and you got the teams and you put the guys on each of the teams. And I used to collect the NFL football ones because they had like foil ones and cool.
Was there
ones.
A particular team?
My team NFL? When I was, no, it was all the teams, but yeah, my favorite team was the New York Giants. And, I know. I liked Lawrence Taylor before I knew what kind of a person he was. So another wrestling tie-in.
Sorry, I should guess. And yeah, I love the New York Giants. El Chaco.
I ended up liking the Arizona Cardinals later because I hate myself. No, I ended up, so I would like shovel walks and save up money and do little chores and save my allowance. And I would spend on these stupid Panini sticker books to try to collect the whole thing. It was Lee and Craig. And Craig was the other guy. And I remember one day Craig comes and he sees that we're going to trade in these sticker books and he's got a full one. We're like, whoa, wow. And he's hawking it to sell it. So somebody buys that one off of him and they got the full one off of him. 2 days later, he comes back. He's got another full one. I'm like, what is going on with Craig?
Stealing them?
He was stealing them. He was stealing them from our Max, which was our convenience store that was nearby. And he wasn't just stealing those. Like, he was a clown. And so, like, what he would do is he would steal condoms. And he would fill the condoms with snow. And he'd tie them up he would climb up the basketball pole and then tie them under the basketball hoop and then hang them down. So basically, when you're shooting baskets, they come through this like gauntlet of like frozen condoms. And like, we didn't even think about or know what condoms look like at that point in time. All of a sudden, like, this evil is coming in and then the girl, she would like offer to show people her boobs for money. Like, this is grade six. And like, this is like nobody had boobs like this, but this was like,
this is public school. Thing.
Yeah. Wow. And then Lee, this was the guy who was in my class. So in my class, once he showed up, all of a sudden people's stuff goes missing, like from their desks. So like, if you had like a nice, like I had this like pen and it was like one of those pens where you could like click a thing and have the different colors, like green, red, black, And it just went missing and I had it and I liked it. And then he was using it. And I went to the teacher and I was like, hey, like clearly he's got my thing. And she's like, you don't have proof. You can't accuse him. And it was this weird thing because before those guys came, there was enforcement of the rules. And then slowly when these guys came in, right, all the things that we would get in trouble for, these guys weren't getting in trouble for. And they used to do these like aptitude tests, you know, because like, you know, there's different places like they have the GATE program. We had Ed Plus and we had a few things. And like in order to get kind of picked to go into these programs, like it depended on your aptitude test. Right. And my parents were, you know, we were offered, like I was in Ed Plus at the Catholic school. And then when I came to the public school, they had sort of a system like that. And then they were trying to say like, you should be going into this other system, but like, I don't know. I wasn't like an achievement-aholic, but I would say this, like I thought these things were important. Like I wanted to show what my aptitude was on these things. And we would be trying to write this thing, and this Lee guy would just be shouting out, ACDC, ACDC. And he was like clowning around, throwing his thing up. He'd go up to people's things and throw their tests off, and the teacher couldn't do a thing. Just couldn't do a thing. Like he kept getting punished, but not really. And you'd be thinking to yourself, yeah, like, when are they going to suspend this guy? When are they going to do something about this? And so he stole my pen, but then another time I had my bike lock key because we ended up needing bike locks, and I got the U-lock thing. Mm-hmm. And this was before the internet, so I didn't know about like, you know, the pen trick or anything like that to like open mm-hmm. these things at the time. But like, it went missing, and I'll never forget it because I'm there on a weekend with my dad and a hacksaw sawing
through your unlock.
It took hours. It took so long to get this thing because it was such a tough metal, and we went through it finally. And then like, my dad didn't yell at me or anything. He didn't, you know, he didn't give me a hard time about it. He just went with me and we got it done. But you know, when I was growing up, like if you went to a friend's house,
can I interrupt?
Yeah. So
I'd like to tell a story about stealing in elementary school because
sure.
And it's a great dad story too.
Okay.
And it's stayed with me for a very, very long time. The story. I feel like it shaped who I am as a person. But when I was in the fourth or fifth grade, I was I got a watch for Christmas, like a nice Timex watch. It's probably $20 or something, you know.
Yeah. It had a stopwatch on it.
It did. It had a stopwatch. It had an alarm. It had Indiglo. It had all the stuff. All the stuff on it, right? And it was a cool watch. And something I've learned since elementary school, I have an allergy to nickel. Oh. So if I wear a watch with the stainless steel back, especially a cheap watch with the stainless steel back, i.e. a Timex, I get these terrible rashes underneath my watch. So like I'm wearing this watch right now and I don't have a rash because I now buy, this is on a NATO strap, but this is a composite back watch. I only wear composite back watches or glass back watches now so that I don't, because I have these horrible like round rashes on my wrist.
Interesting.
And so So I'm in elementary school. I have this nice watch. I like it. I want to wear it, but I have this terrible rash on my wrist. So I take it off during the school day and I put it in my desk, just in the edge of my desk. I'll put it back on before the end of the day, put it in the end of my desk, go to lunch, come back, watch is gone. And I was devastated.
It's a loss of innocence.
You know, yeah, it really was the end of my time of thinking that you could just put my watch here and it'll be fine until I get back. And so I had to go home and tell my dad that like the watch is gone. This watch you got me for Christmas, my birthday, whatever the occasion was, it's gone. And my dad told me he said. Don't sweat the small stuff, and it's all small stuff. And I have lived with that lesson for probably 20 years now.
That's a good, I teach the same thing to my son. I always say, you know, I don't say small stuff. I just say it's stuff, you know,
cause what's your dad, you know, you're hacking through that bike lock.
Yeah.
How can he be mad at you? You didn't do anything. You put the key in your desk where it should theoretically be safe until you need to get the key again. Where else are you going to put it?
That's
where else are you going to put the watch?
Safe. Maybe in my jacket pocket, but like I didn't think anything of it.
Yeah.
And it's funny because like that cascaded. It just cascaded. Because when I was a kid, if you know, like this isn't smartphone times. This isn't times where you didn't call ahead of time to like go. You knew where your friends were because all the bikes were on the front lawn. So if everybody was like playing like Nintendo or something, you'd know where they were because all the bikes
there's a pile were on of the bikes front in the lawn. Front yard. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you just so rode up. You just rode up and you did the thing where you stood up on one leg and just
let it go on its distance. Own.
Yeah.
I had a BMX Shogun bike and it had the original seat and the seat was cracked. And if you didn't ride it right, that would pinch and it would rip your shorts. And I had like two pairs of shorts ruined by it. So I got good at just kind of riding, you know, like kind of half standing, you know, while I was riding it a lot. And I only sit down like for bits, but if I'm going to pop up, like I gotta be careful. And so I always remember that. And I had specific stickers on the bike and I knew exactly which one was my bike. And I would come home and I'd put it in the backyard or I'd put it in the shed.
Yeah.
And then it got stolen.
Yeah.
And it got stolen and it sucked because it was like, I was already growing out of the bike, but it was like a good bike and I could have given it to my brother or something like that. And later on, like when I was in junior high, we went to a different like community we had to bus to this community to go there. And I'm there and I used to play this game called, was it an SNK game? It was a total ripoff of Street Fighter 2 called World Heroes. And we used to go to this 7-Eleven at lunchtime, plop our quarters in, play each other. And there was this one kid who came in, didn't go to our school. And he would come in and he would just kick our asses at this game. He just like this total M. Bison knockoff guy. He would just like cheap shot you all the way through. And so like we learned like, okay, just select that guy and beat him.
Yeah.
So I finally did that. I finally beat that guy and I had like a, you know, like a yeah moment, right? And then he just changes to another player, has some other cheap way of winning, and he ends up beating me. And my friends laughed at me. And then we get outside and we're walking out and we see this guy get on the bike. And it was my bike.
It was your bike.
It was my bike with the seat taken off, but it had all the stickers.
And he didn't beat
me. And I couldn't. No, but I couldn't catch. I never saw him again because I was like, that's my bike. And I never saw him again. And the thing is like, I remember when I was thinking about it afterwards and I was like, I knew the community I was in. The community I was in, we were in a nice community and then we were bused to a rougher community. Mm-hmm. And when we went to that rougher community and they were, I remember I met so many other kids. I had this one kid I brought over to my house for dinner, like for, you know, to come hang out. You know, I met him at school, came over to our house, got to have dinner with him. You know, he had dinner. I thought we had a great time. Next day we go to school and the guy absolutely hates my guts and is absolutely just like hates my guts. It was a complete betrayal. Had no idea what happened. And what else is he was jealous. I had a happy family that loved each other and treated each other right. And he didn't. And you can clearly tell he didn't. And I realized like that kid who stole my bike. Oh, I don't think he stole my bike because he would not have been able to get all the way to my neighborhood to go and steal. His dad stole the bike or his dad bought it or his parents bought the stolen bike from somebody else. And his situation was different than mine because my bike got stolen. And then later on, I ended up getting another bike. Mm-hmm. But like you have to kind of put those things into perspective and be like, okay, like this is the real world. This is what it's like. And this is what we're teaching our kids. Unfortunately, is like, this is what you got to get prepared for, kid, you know, tough shenanigans, you know, like you're going to have to get out there and you're just gonna have to get used to this stuff sucking all the time. And it's like, no, I refuse.
Plant trees.
I refuse. And that's why I took my family and we live in a rural area and we know our neighbors and we get to know our neighbors. And it's important to know your neighbors. And there's a no-no book called Culture of Critique by a sociologist named Kevin MacDonald. And in it, he talks about how like a lot of European cultures are high trust societies because of winter, right? Because if you don't trust your neighbor in a lot of these places you're living, like, I mean, I'm from Canada. I grew up in Canada. My ancestors came to Canada. They came to Canada and then they settled in Canada in harsh conditions. They built up their ranches. They built up their properties. They built their own houses. They made it through. And the only way they made it through is by trusting their neighbor and getting along with their neighbor. And like, you know, there's other cultures around the world. So such as like,
Norway, very wintery place. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why the richest nation on the planet, but things have changed in the last 25 years.
I wonder what, but but like
I couldn't even begin to explain.
No,
I've never been there, so
crapshoot. Yeah, but like what's interesting is that this concept of you bring up about your IMLF. What was it?
Kevin MacDonald? Yilmaf,
and like the thing is that. Don't order that on Amazon. You'll get it put on a list. the thing that I was going to say is he brings up about other cultures, especially those who, let's say, have arranged marriages, right? So if you have an arranged marriage, a lot of times it's like this family and this family are wanting to combine the families. It's like a strategic endeavor. And like mm-hmm. down here in Paraguay, I know full well that like, I have friends. I have colleagues down here. I mean, I have lots of Paraguayan friends. I also know don't bother inviting them over on a Sunday for dinner because they're with their family and their family is large. It's cousins, it's aunts, it's uncles. It's a big deal. They put a lot of stock into family, but it's not a high trust culture. Those families are together because those are the only ones they know well enough. And they, when they talk to you about everything, they tell you not to trust anybody. And so the thing is that they will stick up for each other. Even if Uncle Tom is a crook, they will go to bat for him because snitches get stitches kind of thing. And yeah. they will back up a person who's dishonest and acting badly. So when I was in Canada, in Calgary, and this, everything had kind of changed. I said to my wife, I was like, man, I don't get it. We are not getting like, it's hard to connect with people. It's hard to, like, you know, like our kids playing with their kids. It's like really hard. When did that change? It changed when we went back to the church. It changed when I had my conversion. Because all of a sudden when I went to the church, it was like, yeah, we choose to be here. We choose to be here and we have a similar value system and a similar belief system. This works for us. So what ended up happening over time is like, I have this really great group of friends that I'm in contact with every day on Signal, and we post things to each other and we inform one another and we stick up for one another. And like, you know, we would do these things where we would do like a worker bee. When we were getting ready for selling our house, I put a call out to them, and all of a sudden 12 guys came over to my house in the morning, not to help me move, but to help paint the entire house and to like help dismantle furniture and do all kinds of stuff to like get the thing ready. Like, we had to paint the fence. We had guys doing the drywalling in the garage and all that kind of stuff. And we had it done by lunch because there were so many of us, and it was great. And these are the kind of things that like you choose your community. So in a lot of those European cultures, like if you don't trust your neighbor, if your neighbor is a total crook, you're not going to help him when the winter comes and he needs help. You're not going to bail him out. You have to learn how to trust one another. And the low context part of this show, low context is direct communication. So there's high context and there's low context communication. Low context means it's not reading into body language. It's not looking into, you know, like saving face all the time. It is okay to tell somebody, hey man, I'm not buying your BS. It's not working on me. Like, you got to be straight with me. Be straight with me. And that's one of the things that you probably like with a lot of your friends, is that you can be honest with them. You don't have to be like talking around them or anything like that. Like, you, a lot of people bring up about how like men and women are very different in how they communicate. But a lot of that is biological. A lot of women will gossip, right? They'll gossip. They'll tell a lot of those things. But the reason why they have to do that is because in a society where you have to trust one another, if they're picking a partner, then you need gossip. If that guy's a drunk, don't go with him. Yeah. He's a drunk, right? But they save face by talking to each other, and they save face because they don't want to make it like a direct thing, because if their husband dies in battle, or if their husband gets run over by their, you know, by an ox cart, they need each other to bail each other out. So it serves a purpose. And so I guess the thing that I'm going to kind of pursue with this show is, I really want to ask a lot of people, who do you trust? How do you trust them? And how do you foresee getting back to that? Is that dead? Or is it not dead? And can we possibly, you know, come around at some point in time? I think there's a way, but I haven't quite figured out that way yet. And I think that if I talk to enough people who know things and have good experiences about certain things, then maybe we can kind of scratch the surface and figure out what it is that we need to do in this society where we can't trust the news, we can't trust the media, we can't trust our teachers, we can't trust our politicians, and we can't trust each other in a lot of ways. And that, I think, is something that, like, either we're going to need some sort of monumental event to take place that'll change everybody and reset everybody, or we have to work on it internally and kind of balance that out and put it out into the world at how to trust people. And I think that, like, there's a lot of stuff to gain from that. I've been, you know, I took my degrees in economics, and one of the things that we studied in economics was game theory. So in a future episode, I'm probably going to talk about how they've done all types of studies on game theory. What are the winning strategies, like the prisoner dilemma, how to win the prisoner dilemma? And it's not the way you think. And it's really interesting how those kind of things play out. But I should probably leave it at that, because we've done a really good 2 hours here. And yeah. I think this is a great way to start the show. And I chose you as my first guest because I trust you. And because it's one of those things where, you know, if you're going to come and you're going to start something and setting the stage for how this is going to go, hey, who better to start it with than somebody who
brothers.
Exactly. Yeah. So this has been High Trust, low context with El Chaco. I want to thank my guest, Tab Burt, for coming in here. Thank you all for joining us, being a part of this. And on that note, ciao, ciao.
Hasta luego.